I would like to just tell you briefly a little bit of the publicity that aerobics has received, because I think it'll help you maybe to understand a little bit better about the program, perhaps. When the book was first published, my husband, I think you can probably hear me without this mic, but when my husband first wrote aerobics, he was a lieutenant colonel in the, well, he was a major when he first wrote in the Air Force, and he had been to Harvard and had studied exercise physiology and had really initially started working with the astronauts, and he found that this was not something to be restricted to a certain group, that exercise had benefits that helped people of all ages and in all walks of life, and this is why he kind of got disinterested in the space program and started working on this as a an exercise program for the masses. Well, when the first book, Aerobics, A-E-R-O-B-I-C-S, and I'm not pushing the book, but I just wanted you to see how you spell it. Well, this book was published in the March 68 issue of Reader's Digest called How to Feel Fit at Any Age. The book then came out about a couple months later. Well, when my husband and I were working on this book in his little office in San Antonio, we used to think if our relatives all bought a copy, we'd be lucky. We had no idea that it was going to be a bestseller and sell 3 million copies. It's been translated into 5 foreign languages, Spanish, Portuguese, Swedish, and German. I forget the other one. But anyway, it's been internationally accepted. The Air Force then accepted the aerobics program as its official conditioning program to replace the Canadian 5BX program, which was basically a calisthenics-type program. And I'll explain why we felt, why my husband feels that this is not the best type of exercise alone, anyway. I know we have football players here, and I'll have to be careful. But anyway, this is why I have... I want to point out, though, before I go any further, right here now, I want you to know that the Baltimore Colts and the University of Nebraska both use the aerobics conditioning program, and you see how they placed this year, and also the... And you might also like to know that the Brazilian soccer team, which is the World Cup champions, as you know, of course, soccer to the rest of the world is what football is to this country, but announced in their papers and magazines that they trained exclusively on the aerobics conditioning program. So it's been accepted by a lot of the different professional athletes. But to get on a little bit with the publicity, Wheaties, you may have noticed, plugged aerobics on the back of their boxes, and Fleischmann's margarine, and much to, you know, the dissatisfaction of some of the medical profession. But it's just the point I was trying to make is that it had been accepted by the masses. And then Woman's Day did a little story, that little magazine you buy in the grocery store about Ken and I, and... we made a publicity tour, and he was on the Today Show and the Mike Douglas Show and Dick Cavett. And to tell the to tell the truth, will the real Dr. Cooper stand up? And no one got it because my husband's very tall, lanky-looking kind of, you know, and he didn't look like the Charles Atlas type. But we had a lot of, he was on a lot of the national publicity shows. Just the most recent publicity has been, I guess, in the March 9th issue of Time magazine. They did a story about what my husband's doing, because as I kind of got ahead of myself, he got out of the service after 13 years, and I was telling Max he did not retire. You get nothing when you get out. So he didn't retire. He got out because he had 7 more years to go to retirement, and he didn't want to wait 7 more years to pursue this field of medicine. And thanks to the book, it afforded him the opportunity to get out and to go full-time in the practice of preventive and rehabilitative medicine. And this is what he's done in Dallas. He's established the Cooper Clinic and the Institute for Aerobics Research, which is a nonprofit organization. And he's hoping to get into an 8.2-acre estate this coming September, and it's really going to be a showplace. You're going to have jogging trails and indoor track and swimming pools. And so if any of you are in Dallas, I'd like to extend an invitation to you to come out and tour it once it gets opened. And but that's just a little bit of publicity, and we are writing. After the first book came out then, about a couple of years later, we had really didn't intend to write the new aerobics, and it's very poorly titled because, it, you know, sometimes when you write a bestseller, then people just beat a dead horse, you know. They keep coming out with the son of aerobics, you know, and really not changing a thing, you know, still trying to make money off of the original bestseller. Well, that's not what the new aerobics is about. Really, it's a companion book. The first book is a fantastically motivational book, and that's why it sold so well. And some of you here who've read it, as you know, it is a motivational book. The second book came about from the over 8,000 letters that we received from all over the world, people asking questions. Well, my husband and I were our only staff to answer these letters, so we decided a book would be a lot easier way to do it than trying to answer all these letters, which we do try to answer the majority of them. But anyway, the New Aerobics deals mostly, it's a guidelines book for the person who's been hooked. Then this is the guidelines book for him to answer questions and problems that crop up. But I don't want to spend any more time. After I finish, if you'd like to ask some more questions about aerobics, I'd be happy to answer it. It is being used also in the PE curriculum at seven or eight major universities throughout the country, UCLA, I think, and Brigham Young, and University of Tennessee, and several others. And before I go on, I just have to stop here for a moment after that inspiring song for that young lady. I don't see her right now, but in October, we made a tour of colleges and campuses speaking and up into, we went all the way from Halifax, Nova Scotia to San Juan, Puerto Rico. And we spoke at some of the elite, I suppose you could say, schools in the East. And then we came back and ended up the tour speaking at Baylor. And I told my husband that I said, you know, I'm not being prejudiced, but it is such a thrill to get on a campus where the kids are such wholesome, fresh-looking kids. And I'm not saying they don't have some unwholesome-looking types, but to have the opportunity to speak to you young men and women tonight who are dedicated to Christ is really a thrill and a privilege for me because, you know, when I stand up here and speak to a lot of groups, I don't know, it's just kind of, you feel like you're among home folks when you know you're with people who love the Lord and who really try to live for Him. So this is a thrill for me tonight. I hope y'all will get as much out of it as I'm getting. But to start off, when we talk about exercise, I can't think of a subject that's been more abused in this country than the subject of exercise, unless perhaps it's diet. Because you're always hearing about some quickie fad diet that you're going to lose 30 pounds in a week and eat anything you want. And you're also going to hear about you can exercise 30 seconds a day and be physically fit. Well, it just ain't so, and you know it isn't. You don't get something for nothing. You're going to have to put some effort into it. And so when I get up to speak about exercise to a lot of groups, I can just hear them just tune me out. I just feel them tuning me out right then and there because they think, I get all the exercise I need from running around the house. Well, you don't. I have a five-month-old baby, and that's not the right kind of exercise for your heart and lungs. But when you talk about physical fitness, the first thing you have to do is to describe to define what you mean by physical fitness. Because physical fitness means different things to different people. To a young lady, being physically fit may mean having a Miss America-type figure. And to a young man, a weightlifter, it might mean large, bulging muscles. But that's not the kind of fitness that I want to talk to you about tonight. I want to talk to you about cardiovascular pulmonary fitness. And now, that's just medical terminology for your heart, blood vessels, and lung. Cardiovascular pulmonary fitness. You know, it's the muscles that don't show that my husband is interested in conditioning. They don't show, but they're the muscles that keep you going, and they are very important. Now, most exercise physiologists will agree that exercise can be divided into at least four broad categories. And the first category of exercises I want to talk to you about are the isometric. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard of isometrics because a few years ago, they were really the rage. Do you know what isometric exercises are? It's the contraction of a muscle without moving the joint. In other words, if I stand here and I press down hard on this table, I'm contracting a muscle, but I'm not moving a joint. And I know my husband feels about the only thing that's going to get you in condition to do is more isometric exercises. He just doesn't feel it's doing much for your heart and your lungs. The second broad classification are the isotonic or the isophasic exercises. Now, this is also a contraction of a muscle, but it involves the movement of a joint. Now, this example of this would be weightlifting. And I'd like to point out that contrary to what a lot of people think, aerobics and my husband's theories do not put down calisthenics. He says calisthenics are great for building up muscle tone and bodybuilding and what you see. But he does not feel that they are doing much for the heart, lungs, and blood vessels. If you combine a calisthenics program, weightlifting, etc., with an aerobics program, then you're taking care of the outside and the inside. It's kind of like giving a car a new coat of paint when what it really needs is an engine overhaul. You're dressing up the outside, but really what difference does it make if it's going to fall apart inside? So if you combine the two, fine. But he feels in his studies document that you do not get but perhaps a very small amount of cardiovascular pulmonary fitness from calisthenics alone. The third type are the anaerobic exercises. Now, you're getting close here to what we feel are the best exercises, because anaerobic exercises make your body demand large amounts of oxygen, and you're going to find out that's the key to the aerobics program, oxygen, because it's the fuel for the body. But the only problem with the anaerobic exercises is that they are too short in duration. It's like running a 100-yard dash or going out and running around the block. You golf would be an example, because you walk and you stop. Just about the time you get your heart to pumping and really start to do it some good, you stop. It's not an endurance-type exercise, and this is why we don't feel that anaerobics are really the best yet. Now we come to what my husband feels are the best all-around conditioning exercises, and that's aerobics. And I'd like to point out that aerobics does not mean jogging. It's really rather unfortunate in a way, because people feel that if they don't jog or run, that they can't get any exercise to do them any good. Running or jogging, and the only difference, by the way, between the two is the speed. I think if you, I forget the time now, but I think if it's less than a 9-minute mile, if it's more than a 9 or 10 minute mile, it's jogging. If it's less, it's running. Jogging is for those people who can't run fast, really. But jogging is just really one of the many aerobic exercises. Really, the best overall aerobic exercise is swimming. But it's just not that handy for people. And people have latched on to running because it's something that doesn't take much investment in the way of equipment, et cetera. And it's just that you get more benefit faster from running. But other aerobic exercises are cycling, swimming, tennis, handball, basketball, stationary running, skipping rope. Anything that gets the heart rate up and maintains it for about 8 minutes. Now, this is if you're using a fast exercise. You can also get benefit from long, slow distance training, like walking. And anyone over 50, this wouldn't apply to any of you, of course, here tonight, but if you're over 50 years of age and you've been inactive for years, you really shouldn't start anything any more vigorous than a walking program. But I want to, just as simply as I can, and briefly, to keep from boring you, kind of tell you how the aerobics a program was developed, and about the point system, because I know you've heard that you're supposed to get 30 points of exercise a week, etc. My husband has assigned certain amounts of exercise, so many points, and 30 points is what he came up with. Well, let me tell you how that came about. At Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, every young man who comes into the Air Force has to come through basic training at Lackland. So Ken had a captive audience to work with down there with these troops. And he was given the responsibility of designing a conditioning program where you could test thousands and thousands of recruits each year to find out if they were really in good physical condition. So what they did, they would take a young man and put him on a treadmill. Now, a treadmill is nothing but a moving canvas belt. It's motorized and it moves, the treadmill, and you walk on it or run on it. Well, while the subject would be running on this treadmill, they had a thing on his chest, EKG leads, checking his heart rate, and they could watch a picture of his heart rate as he exercised. They also had a large mask over his face and a tube going over here to some large canvas bags, collecting all the expired air that he breathed out. Because the oxygen consumption was the key to good physical fitness. Now, let me explain to you. As we're all sitting here tonight at rest, we're all breathing in, taking in about the same amount of air, but if we had to get up and physically exert ourselves, like the building caught on fire, say, and we had to run outside or physically exert ourselves in some way, the individual who is in better physical condition can utilize more of that oxygen that he's bringing in than the individual who isn't. And that means that he can get it to the all extremities of the body where it's needed for fast action like that. Oxygen is the fuel for the body. And when you are in good physical condition, your body can utilize or use more of that oxygen that it's bringing in than the person who is not in good physical condition. So they found that this was the key of measuring physical fitness, what an individual's maximal oxygen consumption was. And I think if it was 42, it was good. I was trying to think of what Jim Ryan's was. It's something fantastic. But for the average man, 42. Now, you don't have to, it's milliliters per kilogram per minute, but just think of the number, 42. That's all you have to think of. Okay. They knew then that this was what his oxygen consumption could be. But it really was not practical at all to think about putting every man who came into the Air Force on a treadmill and monitoring his heart rate and doing all of this. They didn't have the manpower or the money or anything else to do this or the time. So they had to develop a field test where they could test large numbers of people at a time. Well, this is where the famous or the infamous 12-minute walk-run test came in, where you went out to see how much distance you could cover in 12 minutes. Now, Ken had lots of problems here because he forgot to realize that the average American still thinks that he's in the same kind of condition he was in 15 years ago when he played pro football or could run a mile in so many minutes. They just can't believe if they hadn't been doing anything. In other words, if you haven't done anything for 10 or 15 years, you don't need to go out and take a test to know you're in lousy condition. But the average American just won't accept this, and so they would go out and overextend themselves, and a lot of them had heart attacks and got into problems. And so this is why in the second book, Ken said, don't bother about the test, just start at the bottom. And that's the safe way. But with this test, if you could run a mile in 12 minutes or less, you were considered in good physical condition. And the new book also has age-adjusted categories now, where you don't have to perform as much if you're over 50 or under 40 or 30, etc. But anyway, all right. So they tested him. If they couldn't, the ones who couldn't even, when they tested a man, if he could run a mile, if he could run a mile and a half in 12 minutes, when they brought him back into the laboratory and put him on the treadmill and checked him out, almost without exception, he would have an oxygen consumption of 42. If he couldn't even cover a mile in 12 minutes, his oxygen consumption was very poor. So, this is how they could test large numbers by group running to see about their oxygen consumption. Okay, now the next point is, all right, so they didn't have an oxygen consumption of 42. How are you going to get them up to the point where they did? And this is where my husband devised the point system. He quantitated. He would 15 minutes of, say, cycling at such and such speed, or running, like I run a mile and a half in 12 minutes, that's 6 points. And he gave certain amounts of exercise in so many periods, you know, in other words, like a certain amount of cycling in so many minutes, so many yards of swimming in so many minutes. Well, he assigned them point values, and he found that if an individual would work up to 30 points a week, that almost without exception, they could test them and their oxygen consumption would get up to 42. Now, it didn't mean that they had to get, they could get this 30 points a week cycling one day, running one day, swimming, etc. But that was the key. They found that they had to get them up to at least 30 points of exercise a week. And, you know, this doesn't apply here tonight, but I like to throw this in, because when you say this, sometimes I speak to older groups. I'll tell you, a real challenge was when I had to speak to the Retired School Teachers Association, and they started at 75 up. And you get up and talk about exercise, that was a real challenge. But it's amazing how many of them were interested. But for the people who say, well, I couldn't possibly get 30 points of exercise a week because I'm just too old to start, I want to read you a letter. Like I said, we received over 8,000 letters, and this was one that my husband started his second book off with because it was such a classic. He says, Dear Dr. Cooper, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for the aerobics conditioning program. I have followed the program faithfully for over 9 months. During the past 6 months, I have been averaging at least 30 points per week entirely by walking. I sleep better, feel better, and have gone through the winter without any medical problems for the first time in years, and I am anxiously awaiting my 94th year. So don't tell me you're too old. In y'all's case, you wouldn't anyway, but you can get your 30 points a week with just walking. So don't think that you have to run, because as the kids say nowadays, if running isn't my bag, well, boy, you can tell I'm dated. I would have said, isn't my cup of tea. but don't think that you have to run. There's another story. Speaking of age, I'm sure we had the opportunity when we were out in California, oh, I guess it was last year, to meet Larry Lewis, this guy who's 103 years old. I'm sure some of you must have read about him in the paper. He's 103. He runs 6 miles every morning before going to work as a banquet waiter in the Sir Francis Hotel in San Francisco. And Larry, when we were out there, by the way, he introduced us to his wife. He said, this is my child bride. She's 82. But Larry is quite a character, and on his birthday each year, he likes to run a 100-yard dash. And this year, I think he ran it in 17.3, which isn't bad. And he said that Larry says that he now claims that he holds the world's record for the 100-yard dash for men over 100 years of age. And I doubt if he's challenged very soon. But now I've explained a little bit about the aerobics program. Now, let me tell you now, once you get involved in a regular conditioning program, here are some of the benefits that you can expect to receive. One of the things that you'll notice that will happen is that your lungs operate more efficiently. Well, now, what difference does that make? Well, it makes a lot of difference to an emphysema patient. And I think a lot of you know that emphysema is a real problem in this country. And I know my husband in San Antonio at Lackland had a lot of emphysema patients come to him. I remember one in particular who said that he spent his whole life just trying to breathe. He couldn't even get up and walk across a room like this without stopping two or three times to rest. He had severe emphysema. Now, let me make this crystal clear. Isn't that what Nixon said? Perfectly clear that you're not going to cure emphysema necessarily with running. But I am saying that this man and many other emphysema patients have responded to a regular conditioning program. Of course, they have to do this under medical supervision. But my husband started this man out walking a block at a time, I think. Well, over a period, I think, of a year and a half, he got to where he could walk a mile and a half in, I forget the exact time. But to this man, this was a new life because it meant he could play football on Saturday afternoon with his children, or that he could get through a day without just sitting there trying to breathe. He said he used to get up an hour early every morning just to start breathing, you know, trying to breathe before he went to work. But you know what happens? Most of us just breathe out of about the top half of our lungs. And that's why when you go out and you start exercising everything real hard, well, you hurt. You're trying to force air down into the lower parts of your lungs, and it's kind of like a child's balloon when it's been lying around the house and the air starts to go out of it, and you know how it gets kind of sticky toward the bottom, and trying to force air into those lungs and use them. Well, you'll find that once you become involved in a conditioning program, you can ventilate easier. Another thing that happens is that your blood vessels enlarge. Now, we've received letters from women all over the country stating that their varicosities or their varicose veins have improved once they became involved in a regular conditioning program. Now, there's nothing in the scientific literature to document that conditioning will help varicose veins, but I know that a lot of people think it's helped theirs. Do you know what happens when you get a varicose vein? The vein loses its elasticity, its stretchiness, and the blood pools down in there and makes that dark, ugly spot on your leg. Well, they feel that perhaps with regular conditioning that you build up the integrity of the vessel and that perhaps this is why it helps. And like I say, it's not scientifically documented, but we received hundreds of letters from women thinking that it's helped their problems. Another thing that happens, another benefit you can expect to receive, is that your heart becomes a more efficient pump. I have to stop here and kind of give my little testimony about how I got involved in a conditioning program. I wasn't always gung-ho about running, I'll tell you for sure. It only took my husband 7 years to motivate me. So if I don't motivate y'all tonight, I won't be too discouraged. But when I finally, what really made me start, I'm kind of ashamed to tell this story, but it's the truth. One night we were watching television, and Ken said, Millie, take my pulse, see what my resting heart rate is while we're sitting here tonight. So I did, and it was about 50 beats a minute. So out of curiosity, really, I said, well, take mine. And he did, and it was about 80 beats a minute. And I said, well, so what? 30 beats a minute difference, that's not so much. And he said, do you know that tonight, while we're asleep, that means that your heart is going to beat about 10,000 beats more than mine, and you're wearing out that much faster? And I said, not on your life. Boy, I could see another woman moving in right then and there. I hate to admit that jealousy motivated me, but it made me think anyway, I'll tell you. So I decided I was going to do something about it. But first of all, let me explain what that means. It means that a person who's in conditions, now a low resting heart rate, let me point this out. If you take your pulse, if you're deconditioned, in other words, you haven't been doing too much, your heart rate will probably run about 80 maybe or other. But now some people will have a low resting heart rate, but it's only if you have a low resting heart rate in response to a conditioning program that it's considered good. See, what happens is that when you get in condition, your heart, say our heart, that meant, say take Ken and I, his was beating 50 beats a minute and mine was beating 80 beats a minute, but we were pumping out the same amount of blood, but it was taking my heart 30 beats more a minute. It was having to work harder each minute to pump out the same amount of blood. And when you get involved in a regular conditioning program, your heart beats it pumps out more blood with each stroke. And I think it's Jim Ryan. Now, this is where I was thinking about the... I forgot his oxygen consumption. I think it was 68. But his resting heart rate has been documented, I think, as low as 34 beats a minute. Phenomenal. Just think about that. Such a strong pump. And, you know, this is for the athletes here. My husband went to OU way back there. I'll just skip over when. But he ran track here. And it's amazing at how so many people think they don't want their son to be a football player or an athlete or something because they think he's going to get an athlete's heart. How many of you heard that? Going to get an athlete's heart. Boy, you build up this big, strong heart, you know, a big heart, and then it's going to all turn to flab. Well, don't worry about that because there's no truth in it. As a matter, you just wipe that out of your mind. But actually, they're beginning to wonder now if perhaps the little bit larger heart of the athlete isn't more the normal heart. And the smaller heart is perhaps the abnormal heart because the heart's a muscle. And if it's the only pump that I know of, the more you use it, the stronger it gets. But this is one thing that happens. I want to go on about my little story here. Two marvelous things happened after this little spree of jealousy that got me out running the next morning. I put our little 2-year-old daughter in a stroller and our fat blonde cocker spaniel on a leash. And in 2 years, it took me a year before I could run a mile nonstop. The dog died. She didn't make it. I guess it was too late for her, but I made it. And I don't know if she had a heart attack or not, but she didn't make it. But I did. And two marvelous things happened to me during that year. The first thing that Ken felt was really marvelous is that my resting heart rate dropped from 80 beats a minute to 57 beats a minute. Now, Ken thought that was just fantastic. But, girls, it wasn't nearly as fantastic as what I felt was important. I dropped 2 dress sizes. Now, I have a baby 5 months old right now, and I've got those dress sizes to drop all over again. But I dropped 2 dress sizes from inches. And I didn't lose too much weight, but I lost a lot of inches. And that was important to me because I told my husband, I said, you can get up and talk until you are blue in the face to women about what exercise is going to do for their heart and their lungs and their blood vessels, and they could care less. They want to look good. Well, and I'm all for that. But when you do exercise, you get the best of both. You get shaped up on the outside as well as the inside. I want to go on now and tell you another benefit that you can expect to receive. Your digestion improves. And this is particularly important for, say, elderly people in nursing homes. They encourage them to take long walks for irregularity. And if you have a problem with digestion, it's just good for your digestion in general. Another thing that happens is it helps you to sleep better. Now, a lot of people write us. It's kind of interesting because some of them said that they suffered from insomnia before they started exercising, but now they exercise right before they go to bed in the evening and they just sleep like a log. Other people state that they have to exercise in the morning because it keys them up, gets them all geared up, and they can't relax if they exercise, you know, too close to before going to bed. The time of day is important. I might point out here that the attrition rate, the dropout rate, is higher in the evening exercisers than the morning. I don't know, I'm a morning exerciser. It just seems to me like if you get it up and get it done first thing in the morning, that you'll stick with your program a little better because you can think of all kinds of reasons during the day, you know, not to exercise. My husband, however, is an evening exerciser because he's a very quiet man but just lets tensions build up inside of him, and he feels that if he couldn't, when he got home from the day, and he feels just, you know, like ready to explode sometimes from the frustration, if he'll go out and run 2 or 3 miles before dinner, and he's 40 now, And he'll run 2 or 3 miles before dinner and just come back like a new person. So it depends on the individual as to the time of day. Another thing that happens, a benefit you can expect to receive, is that you become less of a hypochondriac. I don't know that you don't have as many aches and pains like headaches, sore throats, etc., but you just don't think about them as much. I can remember sometimes going out to exercise when I had a splitting headache. And when I got back, I don't know that the headache was gone, but I was so tired, I just didn't think about it. You know, I just had forgotten all about it. But you don't have to remember each of these individual things I mentioned. Just think of them collectively as the training effect, because these are all beautiful benefits that just click right into place once you achieve a training effect. And you will achieve a training effect if you get your 30 points of exercise per week regularly. And think also of this training effect as practicing preventive medicine, because that's what you're doing. And, you know, there's not a one of us that would even consider probably getting up in the morning and not brushing our teeth. You always have time for that. I don't care what. You'll find time. You know what? You've been brainwashed that brushing your teeth is practicing good dental hygiene. And it is. It's true. But we haven't been brainwashed yet that practicing 15 minutes or so of vigorous exercise each day is practicing preventive medicine. And you can live without your teeth, but you can't live without a good heart, lungs, and blood vessels. And as future young mothers and fathers, it's extremely important that you impress upon your children it's just as important for them to get some vigorous activity each day as it is for them to brush their teeth. I want to just real briefly tell you a few clinical or a few medical problems that my husband has documented in the scientific literature as having responded to regular conditioning programs. The first one is heart disease, and there's not a young man in this room who shouldn't perk up and listen with both ears to this, because you are prime candidates, as you know. They're documenting, well, Enos, in his study, he did autopsies on Korean casualties. The average age was 23 years of age, and I think in over 75% of them, he showed already beginning signs of coronary disease. In other words, the aging process is starting in our young men in this country as young as 23 years of age. And that is deplorable. Let me give you a few statistics that'll bear this out. They did a study on young men between the ages of 35 and 45 years of age per 100,000 population. In Sweden, the death rate in these young men from heart disease was 19.6%. They're very active in Sweden, as you know. They swim, cycle, ski, everything. In the Netherlands, it was 33.4%. I've been to Amsterdam, and I'm amazed in the Netherlands to see couples riding bicycles dressed to the hilt. I mean, you know, they ride bicycles every place they go. It's a rush hour on the expressway of bicycles, if you can believe it. But they're very active. Now, think about this. Sweden, 19.6%. The Netherlands, 33.4%. In the United States of America, it is 90.6% in our young men, 35 to 45 years of age. We lead the world in heart disease in this country. We're one of the most affluent nations, but we still lead the world. Now, let me tell you a few factors. There's a triad that exists in this country. If these factors exist in your life, and I'm going to get to the girls in a minute, because the American women also lead the world, but their death rate, women's death rate in general, is a little lower to a certain point, and I'll tell you that in just a minute. But if these factors exist in your life, your chances of having a heart attack are tremendously increased. If you eat a high saturated fat diet, and do you know what that is? The typical American diet is a high saturated fat diet. If you're inactive, if you're in a stressful position, such as a student or an executive, etc., let me tell you, if you add two more factors to that, then you're sitting on a keg of dynamite. If you add the fact that you smoke, and then you add the fact that you come from a family with a history of coronary disease. Well, now, you can't do a thing about heredity. You can't do perhaps too much about stress. But my goodness, can you ever do anything about those other three? Diet, inactivity, and smoking. You know, under this stress factor, I heard an interesting comment by Dr. Joyce Brothers on the... Oh, I'm sure you all know who she is. She's some child psychologist or something. And she was on some TV show. You know, there's so... If you watch TV as a housewife like I do, you get tuned out to all these authorities, you know, on how to raise your children when they're running around and you want to smack them one and they tell you to smile. Who is that? My husband was on a program with Dr. Haim Gnaud or Gnaud, you know. And y'all don't... This doesn't pertain to you. You're not raising children right now. But anyway, Dr. Joyce Brothers happened to be on this TV show and she was talking about a study that was done at Harvard. And they found that men who were unfaithful to their wives had a higher incidence of heart attacks than men who were... I should have served them right if they were unfaithful. But not really. But anyway, I guess the fact that they were so afraid they were going to get caught that they were under tremendous stress. But this was an actual study, if you could imagine. But anyway, these are some factors that are extremely important for you as young men right today to start practicing. Because my husband sees patients in their late 20s and early 30s already who've had a heart attack or who are suffering from heart disease. So it's very important because you got it staring you in the face every day you grow older. But this one factor... It's such a pleasure. I really can't chastise, I'm sure, many of you here, because I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, probably don't smoke. But there's just nothing good to be said for smoking. Just nothing. And as intelligent individuals, I'm sure you've read enough and seen enough to know that. But they've always known that smoking plays a role in lung disease. But now they've documented and shown what a tremendous role it also plays in heart disease. They've shown that if you smoke, your chances of having a heart attack are 4 times greater than the person who doesn't smoke. And I think it's interesting to point out, I was telling Max before I got up here to speak, that people always say, well, are you trying to tell me that if I exercise, Dr. Cooper, I'm not going to have a heart attack? No, that's not what he's saying. But there is scientific documentation, and to a scientist, the reason I keep using this is if a fact is going to be accepted, it's got to be documented in the scientific world. And it is scientifically documented that if a man has a heart attack and he has been exercising regularly, that his chances are 4 times greater of surviving that heart attack than the man who has not been exercising regularly. And also, they have found that people who don't die immediately from a heart attack over the next preceding few weeks or months, another percent will die, etc. But they have found in the regular exercisers that this is reduced tremendously. So, no, we can't make the statement that exercise is going to keep you from having a heart attack. I know Ken's got, well, in all of these letters, I would say out of the 7,000 or 8,000, not more than maybe 1% have been critical. But every now and then he does get a letter saying, Dr. Cooper, how many people do you think you've killed probably with your exercise program? And needless to say, it upsets him. And he always replies specifically to those people, if he doesn't have time to answer the good testimony of, that how many people would have died if they hadn't been doing something regularly. And that's very important, because people are going to die. Every minute they're dying practically of heart disease, talking, eating, lying in bed. And at least you could get out and practice some preventive medicine. It may not keep you from having a heart attack, but it may help your chances of surviving it. Also, while we're talking about cigarettes, I always tell mothers, I speak a lot to PTA groups and medical wives groups and things like this, and I tell these mothers, because they're usually puffing up a storm, you know, that I realize that I'm not going to change your mind. If you smoke, you're an intelligent adult, you're probably going to keep on smoking if that's what you want to do. But by all means, encourage your children not to smoke. Because in the studies at Lackland that my husband did, they found, first of all, when these young men came into the Air Force, the average age was 18 and 19, et cetera, that the men who didn't smoke were already in clearly the best physical condition just because they didn't smoke. They could perform better on the 12-minute test. But it's so important that you encourage your children not to smoke, because they found that if an individual smoked as few, now get this, as few as 10 cigarettes per day, they would never be able to reach their maximal performance. And it's critical for athletes. I think they're all aware of that. But it's also critical with the lung and heart disease problem in this country for just anyone to encourage their children not to smoke. And while we're on children or students, do you know that there's a correlation between physical fitness performance and your academic proficiency? Now, I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that if you exercise, you're going to get smarter, because you don't. But you know what happens is, they found that the students who, well, Ken did this study down at Maxwell Air Force Base at the Squadron Officer School, and these young men, and they found when they tested these young men on the 12-minute test, the ones who could run the farthest in 12 minutes made the best grades. And it was the most beautiful study, because if you're interested in statistics, right down the line, everyone was in order. Every man, according to how he performed in 12 minutes, the poorest man on the 12-minute test was at the bottom of the class. There is a correlation between academic proficiency and physical fitness. Now, true, you don't get any smarter, but you know what happens? You're more alert. You're more responsive and receptive. You can stay awake better to study longer. So it does help improve your grades sometimes if you do get involved in a physical conditioning program. I want to just briefly tell you about a couple more medical problems that have responded. My father is an outstanding example of one back here, and I just have to kind of give his little story. Daddy's about 62, and I'll tell you, I'll bet you there are a lot of you here in the room that have a hard time keeping up with him on the 2.5-mile jog, because he really moves out, I'll tell you. But Daddy weighed about three or four months ago. Daddy, how many months? When did you start dieting? About 3 months ago, 198 pounds. He went down through regular conditioning, and he, with his walking program and his dieting, he got down to 156. Well, now that's nice, because he looks better and everything, but that wasn't the important thing. Before, he always had to take blood pressure medication, and then had a hard time keeping it low, even on medication. But when my husband checked him this last time, he had dropped to, he was 122 over 80 without medication. And this is what my husband has found in the military so often. He was a flight surgeon. It was very important for him to keep his pilots flying because it meant $200 or $300 a month extra money for them. They could not fly if he had to put them on medication. So he found that with regular conditioning programs, so many things like adult onset diabetes, this diabetes that you get once you get, in middle age and get fat and deconditioned, that's not the type you're born with. This is adult onset, acquired diabetes. That, high blood pressure, ulcer disease, so many of these conditions could be controlled. Now, I'm not saying cured, but controlled without medication once they became involved in a regular conditioning program. And when I say regular conditioning program, this means that you're going to have to, for the rest of your life, if you're really going to experience the joy of living, what I call my presentation, exercise at least every other day. That's about the least amount that you can get away with. Another condition that's responded is ulcer disease. And I know my husband always had his ulcer patients exercise at the end of the day, because this is when most people just have that acid just pouring into their stomach. I mean, you know, they're really tense and keyed up from the day. And he found that if he would have them exercise before they went home to dinner, that it helped them tremendously. And on ulcer disease, I want to point out an example. Maxie's textbook on preventive medicine and public health gave a story which is fascinating to me. They took dogs, and they injected these dogs with an acid-producing medication called histamine. And with regularity, they could produce ulcers in all of these dogs. But then they divided the dogs, injected them all with histamine, but one group of dogs, they exercised at least twice a day. No, at least once a day. And then the other dogs, they just let stay in the cage and do nothing. In the dogs that they exercised at least once a day, they could not produce an ulcer. And then that's with dogs, but most of our medical discoveries have come from animal experimentation, so that is something very interesting to think about. Now, I want to ask you a question. Do you know what condition that over 50 million Americans are afflicted with? 50 million Americans suffer from this condition. Obesity. Yeah. 25% of the American population are at least 15 pounds overweight. Now, I know when I stand up here and I talk about obesity, I used to before I had a baby and kind of got a little few extra pounds myself, but people would think, oh, well, she probably never dieted too much and she doesn't know how horrible it is to be hungry. Well, that's not true, because I come from a family where obesity is a problem. I have a sister who at one time was over 200 pounds, and she's only 6 years older than I am. And she has got involved recently in a conditioning walking. She's walking a mile and a half a day and riding a stationary bicycle, combining it with a 1,000-calorie diet, and she's already dropped tremendous amounts of weight. And it's just amazing what a difference an individual looks like and how they feel. And I know in all the letters that we receive from people all over the country, they say, even if you couldn't document physiologically what happens to an individual once he becomes involved in a conditioning program, what happens to him psychologically is incredible. If you don't believe it, you ought to read some of the testimonial letters we receive. They change, and they've actually shown with personality profile testing that an individual's personality will change in response to a regular conditioning program. But to go on, when we got married, my husband told me, he said, now, Millie, I'm going to devote the rest of my life to preaching the benefit and the value of being physically fit, and I'm going to use exercise as a therapeutic tool in the practice of preventive and rehabilitative medicine. And he said, it's just as simple as this. I just can't afford to drag a fat wife around the country. And speaking on these lecture circuits. So he said, we're going to have a little slogan, a little motto in our house. And he said, it's going to be start losing or start looking. Now, I don't believe that. I mean, but I must admit, when I start to take that second serving of dessert, I think about it. But it is important. If you're going to get up and preach something, it's just like if I was preaching the hazards of smoking and standing up here puffing on a cigarette, I don't think I'd be very persuasive. So I could see his point. But the reason my sister's done so well is because when you combined, you know, let me point out this first of all. When you go on a fasting diet, in other words, you're just starving practically, you know, you get real weak and real shaky. You know why you get weak? Because you're burning up about 50% fat and 50% muscle mass. You actually start burning up muscle mass.
Whereas, if you combined that dietary restrictive program with a conditioning program, you're burning up 100% fat. So it's a beautiful twosome when you combine the two, and you will get fantastic results. And, you know, I want to just briefly touch on this. I'm going to finish in just a minute here. About the psychological effects of a exercise program on an individual. My husband is thinking of writing, he's been approached by Zonovan Press to write a book with our former pastor in San Antonio called The Inner Relationship Between Spiritual and Physical Fitness, because there definitely is a relationship, we feel, anyway. And we've had letters from people who, and these letters, by the way, have come from all over the world. We receive letters from people in prison, Trappist monks, movie stars. This one man in prison, I remember, wanted to know how many times he had to run around the exercise pen to get 30 points per week. And several incredible, stories. I was trying to think of some of the other really fascinating ones. But have you ever heard of a place like Suriname? Boy, if we were philatelists, we'd have the best stamp collection in the world, I guess. But anyway, but these letters, it's amazing in looking through them how many of them bear out the fact that a person has a change in their spiritual life, too. As a matter of fact, they start going to church more regularly. I don't know why. I think, really, if you want my own personal opinion, I think it's because one reason is that they just feel so good on Sunday morning. They get up and they're ready to go. And where are most people going? Or hopefully, where are most people going? To church. And I think they really physically feel more like getting up and going. But they definitely do start going to church more regularly. And then the other reason, I think, that when you get physically fit, and you really feel it. And like I say, I call my presentations the joy of living, because there is an exhilaration. There is a joy that comes from really feeling good. I know young people, and you know there's such a difference between living and existing. I know people who are existing at 20 years of age and people who are living at 70 years of age. I'm amazed. I'm 35 years of age, and I don't mind telling you at all, because on most college campuses, I could run the socks off of most of the girls on that campus. They couldn't even, and the boys, I outran the majority of the 18 and 19-year-old recruits coming into the Air Force were so poorly conditioned, my husband would bring me out there to run, and I'm not that good, a mile and a half in 12 minutes. Just to try to shame these guys, but they are so, he said, my own 35-year-old housewife, he delights in saying that. He wants me to keep getting older because it sounds better. It's just deplorable. They couldn't even, this testing I was telling you about, they had to do on a treadmill because these guys don't ride bicycles enough. They are so weak in their legs that they couldn't even give a maximal performance on a stationary bicycle. Now, that's the truth. Their legs, they would take their hands and push their knees down because their legs were so weak. Now, that's true. And these are recruits from all over the United States. So it is important. But anyway, back to this business of between living and existing, there really is a tremendous difference. But, and you know, girls, my husband feels that beauty really is not skin deep. That there's a radiance and a glow about a girl who is physically, or a young woman who is physically active, that an inactive person, a girl, just can't come any place near. He said the way she looks, the way she carries herself, the way she moves, there's just a vitality, there's a radiance about a girl who is physically fit. That in any way, you can see, girls, I had to start running. I couldn't stand all him telling me all that, you know, when I knew I was a lazy slob not doing much. But anyway, it does. There is an exhilaration that comes from being physically fit. Now, if all this sounds like Dr. Cooper's magic elixir to cure everything from snake bites to mother-in-laws, etc., well, that's not what I mean at all. Because exercise will cure some things, perhaps it will help others. But there is no ultimate cure-all, you know that. But like I said before, what it does for you psychologically is important, in my opinion, is what it does for you physiologically. And it's just like when someone loses a loved one. And you say, I know how you feel. But you really don't unless you've experienced it. I mean, you might have all the sympathy and empathy in the world for that person. But unless you have lost a loved one, there is no possible way that you can know how that individual feels. And it's the same way. I can tell you how great, how alive, and how wonderful it is to feel good and physically fit. But until you taste it yourself, it's just like being a Christian. I know, you've known before and after. Some of you are new Christians, I know. There is no way that you can tell and describe that feeling to someone until they've experienced it themselves, and then you have a common bond. And I want to end this presentation with some slides. I have about 6 slides I want to show you. And I've tried to motivate you tonight, if you aren't already involved in some kind of physical conditioning program, to get motivated. But what I want to do, I want to show you some slides of people who are motivated with fantastic handicaps, some of them, and still they're motivated. And I hope that if I haven't convinced you, that just these few slides perhaps will convince you that no matter what your handicap, most of them can be overcome. Let me show you these slides just a minute here.
Now, this is Pop.
Uh-oh. That won't ever do, will it? Yeah, there we go. Anyway, so Pop started cycling. Is this? Yeah, it's still. And at one time, he cycled from Houston, Texas to New York City, averaging 140 miles a day. He's fantastic. He came to San Antonio. When this picture was made, Pop was 70. And he came to San Antonio to enter our famous race from San Antonio to Johnson City, Texas. And it's up 64, just about up and down 64 hills. Well, Pop came in 9th out of a field of 32. And he had a flat tire, he said. That's what slowed him down. But anyway, how would you like to be passed by a 70-year-old man on a bicycle? Now, he's phenomenal. But anyway, that's usually the slide I show for people who say they're too old to get started. Now let me show you another one. This is for those who have children, usually, who ask about how young their children should get started. Now, this picture was made when we were out in California at the Long Beach Witness for Fitness. Jack LaLanne and a bunch of exercise people were there, and we went out to run in this event, and it was just fantastic because they had people of all ages, sizes, and descriptions running. But this little girl is Rami Vasquez. Let me focus it a little better. And Rami is 5 years of age, and she's just finishing a 10-mile run here with her daddy. Now, I don't know, and my husband doesn't really know yet for sure, if this is long-distance running like this is really good for kids that young. But what he usually says, where you really should start regimenting their conditioning program and making sure that they get so much, it's about junior high, about 13 years of age on up. Up until about 13, they seem to have something built in that kind of balances them out. But anyway, Rami just liked to run. And he always says, if your child wants to, you know, fine, but don't push them. You know, don't start trying to make a Jim Ryan at 4 years of age, you know, because competitive, I can't help but feel that, you know, we may put too much emphasis on competition instead of just participation. Because a study was done in California, and I'm just throwing this in because I think it is so important that this physical educator took students and graded them by their performance on a mile run. And at the end of the year, he said what was important, not the fact of what the kids made, A, B, or C, or D, or anything, but it took these kids who had no athletic ability whatsoever. In other words, they would never excel in any sport. And in this country, we seem to equate physical fitness with athletics. In other words, you think to be physically fit, you've got to be a star athlete. And that is so wrong. And with these kids, he said he found that some of these kids who would never be an athlete, it changed their whole attitude toward being physically fit. It made them realize that they, too, could be physically fit, whether they were an athlete or not. And I think that was a very important study. But anyway, this is for the ones who are young. Now, the next slide, for the young ladies who say, I'm not about to run. First of all, it isn't ladylike to sweat. Well, what do you think you do when you dance? I mean, well, I'm in a bad... I've been... I sure hope that this isn't going on the... but you can wipe it out. No, I was a Methodist until I married my husband, and we still have some discussions about that. But anyway... I think in this day and age, most people do dance, whether they dance at home or where they dance. And you may not believe this, but when we were at Harvard and at Boston, they held dances in the church basement in the Baptist churches. And I used to tease my husband, having been a former Methodist, about that. But anyway, when you do other sports, you sweat. And there is nothing unladylike about sweating. As a matter of fact, one lady told me it improved her complexion tremendously because when she would sweat, it would clean out the pores of her face. But anyway, one of the wildest claims we've ever had for what exercise will do for you was the guy who said that his dandruff got better. And he said he thought it was from riding a bicycle and all that invigorating air. But anyway, this next slide is for you girls who say you're going to get muscles in your legs.
Well, this next slide's a young 25-year-old housewife from Canton, Ohio. Now, this really doesn't do Sue justice. Her name's Susan Bailey. At one time, she ran 37 miles nonstop. Sue runs with some men at the YMCA up there, and they call her Super Sue. And the guys can't stand because she is so good. But I think you can see that Sue has a very nice figure. And by the way, girls, I'll tell you, being on the publicity tour for the book, we've had an opportunity to meet a lot of celebrities who use conditioning as a means of keeping young and looking great. And if exercise will make you, if running will make you look like Elkie Summer, I'm going to keep it up. Because Elkie is a real avid runner, by the way. So anyway, now this next slide. But I wish I could make that claim for exercise. I don't know that it'll make you look like her, but it sure makes you feel better. But this next slide is for those of you who say, I can't get shoes to fit my feet, or I get blisters. Well, I think you're going to be really ashamed when you see this next slide if you've used that for an excuse for all these years. Because when we were at this Witness for Fitness, we met this man. His name is Pete Strudwick. He's 37 years of age. He was born with his mother had rubella, I believe, or some a problem before he was born. He was born handicapped because Pete runs marathons with no feet. See number 405 there? I'm sorry, this is not, yeah. I had the privilege of running behind Pete in a 2-mile run because I couldn't keep up with him. He wears prostheses, or artificial feet, when he works. He didn't let his handicap stop him in any way. He's he has his master's degree and is a program computer operator or something in the electronics field. And he is a fantastic individual. But I ran behind him most of the 2-mile run. And he has a little 10-year-old son who's just as perfectly normal as any child. And I want to tell you, as most of you're not parents, but as a parent, to have a child look at you with the pride and admiration in their face that child looked at his father with is an overwhelming thing. He was so proud of his father, he couldn't even keep up with him. But anyway, Pete, after this 2-mile run that we had in Long Beach, wrote us later and told my husband, he said, Dr. Cooper, I just entered the Palos Verdes Marathon. And he said, 26 miles, 385 yards. And he said, I came in last, but they gave me the biggest trophy they had. And I certainly think, what kind of determination does it take like that? This year in the Boston Marathon, they had a legless Vietnam veteran who pushed himself 26 miles, 365 yards in a wheelchair. We have a good friend named Harry Cordellis who runs marathons. And Harry is Harry's 32, and he runs, probably 3.5-hour marathon, which is good for 26 miles. But Harry has been totally blind since birth. And I think one of the most touching stories, one was when he told my husband, he said, I ran the Boston Marathon and only fell down 2 times. But he said in his 10-mile race one day he was running, and he runs with a partner, and they synchronize their arms. They don't hold. They touch arms, you know. And as they run, that he can feel to keep, you know, on the road. And his partner just couldn't keep up. And they were just about to finish the 10-mile run. And his partner dropped out. And Harry was just out there stumbling around. You know, he was just lost. And one of the officials on the side was so touched that he came out and took Harry by the arm and finished the 10-mile run with him. So what kind of dedication, what kind of motivation does it take? What kind of discipline? You know, when we think of ourselves as perfectly normal and healthy and still won't exercise and use our bodies, I just get so disturbed that I just want to say, if you don't want to use what you have, well, give it to somebody who will use it. Because the heart is a muscle. And if you don't use it, you really eventually lose it. Now, this next slide is a patch that they use at Santo. You know, people never really outgrow being children. They still like to get gold stars and patches. Look at the football players. I'm really kind of hitting the football players hard tonight. But I mean, the Letterman. Boy, there's nothing like that jacket. And if a girl gets to wear it, well, back in my day, I don't know what they wear now, drops or pins or what. But anyway, people like something to symbolize that they've earned, that they've worked for. And I think it's great. I'm not putting down your medals and your letters. I think they're marvelous. But Ken found that if these guys organized a group, and they call themselves Cooper's Poopers. And I'll have to get my... I think I remember it.
You got the patch. If you could run a mile and a half in 12 minutes, you got the patch with the large star in the back. If you could make the excellent category of fitness and run a mile and three quarters in 12 minutes, you got the little gold star underneath. And if you could do both of those and run a mile in 6 minutes, then you got the gold wreath around the outside. And then you were called a super duper scooper's pooper. But anyway, no matter what, some people try so hard, but they just can't make the grade. They try as hard as anyone else, but they never can quite make it. So we developed a special patch for them. And this one's known as the Tired Coyote. Thank you very much.